I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Ronald Leopold, Executive Director of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam.
Good evening, everyone. I am Charlotte von Robert, director of Stanford University's Taube Center for Jewish Studies, and welcome to this evening's Charles Michael Lecture with our distinguished guest from Amsterdam, Dr. Ronald Leopold, the executive director of the Anne Frank House, who will share his reflections on a topic of growing importance in the current social and political climate, not only in Europe, but also here in the US, namely the issue of how to deal with the memory of the Holocaust. With the lecture on the victim as icon, moral dilemmas in appropriations of Anne Frank. Dr. Leopold grew up in Groningen in the north of Holland and attended the university there to study history. He has also spent some years in Budapest before moving to Amsterdam in the mid-80s. When he took over the executive directorship of the Anne Frank House, the museum had been reopened in its new shape for 10 years to accommodate the ever-growing numbers of visitors, now I think numbered at over a million visitors annually. In Europe to this day, the diary of Anne Frank is read in public schools. I grew up on that in the mid-80s in German public school. Surely to all those visitors, the space of the museum, the actual hiding place of the family, serves as an important witness function. And I went there as a young high school student myself in the mid-80s. So Ronald, I'm so grateful that you agreed to speak with us tonight. So without further ado, therefore, please help me in welcoming Dr. Leopold to the podium. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. So good evening, everybody. Thank you so much, Charlotte, for this introduction. It's a great honor and a great pleasure to be back in San Francisco. I would like to start with thanking the organizers of this lecture to give me the opportunity to share some of the ideas and thoughts with you on Anne Frank, on her legacy, on how we remember Anne Frank, and all kinds of moral dilemmas that are connected to her legacy. Some of you might have stand in line for the Anne Frank House. Maybe you stood in line for 2 hours to get into the museum. I think Charlotte already mentioned we have 1.3 million visitors every year coming to the Anne Frank House. Half of them are under the age of 30, very young audience, and they come from all corners of the world, young and old, academic professionals and interested individuals, Jewish and non-Jewish. So it's really a place for everyone. And that touches actually on the theme that I would like to explore with you in greater depth today with you. Because the idea that Anne Frank is for everyone and of everyone is actually less self-evident than it might first appear. Since I took up my post as executive director of the Anne Frank House in 2011, I've been confronted with numerous appropriations of Anne Frank, usually for very noble ends, sometimes a bit unfortunate, I would say, and sometimes, in my view, highly problematic. And I would like to share with you some of these dilemmas in the next 45 minutes or so that I will speak. To share with you some of these dilemmas that come up in the context of these appropriations. And I do so because I think these dilemmas are, on the one hand, very important and relevant to the work of the Anne Frank House, but also because they can enhance, I think, the understanding of Anne's legacy, and maybe more in general, when we want to draw lessons from history, how does that work? It's almost 30 years ago that Francis Fukuyama, political scientist from the United States, published his celebrated essay, The End of History. And now what we see is that people are increasingly turning to history in search of understanding what is going on here in this world and what's going on in this country. So when history strikes back, Anne Frank is never far away. And I would therefore like to take you on a journey passing various appropriations of Anne Frank along the way, but doing so obviously as a director of an institution that also has made its own appropriation of her and makes it actually new every day. So in a way, I'm here simultaneously as the observed and the observer, as object and subject of what I'm going to talk about. So at the end of my talk, I will examine a little bit of how we as Anne Frank House do make our own appropriation, if you would call it like that, of Anne Frank, the choices we make and why we make those choices. But let me start this journey in your country, the United States of America, which has played and actually still plays a very important role in the commemoration of Anne Frank. On the 25th of August, 2016, the New York Times published an opinion piece by one of its staff, Nicholas Kristof, under the title, Anne Frank Today is a Syrian Girl. The article was accompanied by two photos, one of Anne Frank and one of Rwanda Hanoun, a five-year-old girl from Aleppo, Syria, who was injured during an airstrike. History rhymes, writes Kristof towards the end of his article, referring to the restrictive admission policy of the U.S. government toward Jewish refugees in the late 30s and early 1940s, and the restrictive admission policy towards Syrian refugees of the Obama administration. And he goes on, and I quote Nicholas Kristof, "There is simply no excuse for the world's collective failure to ensure that Syrian refugee children in neighboring countries at least get schooling. Today, to our shame, Anne Frank is a Syrian girl." Unquote. Now, Nicholas Kristof wrote his article shortly after he had visited the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam and had been confronted with the consequences of the unsuccessful attempts of Otto Frank, Anne's father, the only survivor of those who were in hiding, to flee to America with his family. These attempts collided against an invisible wall of the Roosevelt administration's refugee policy. It was utterly impossible for the Franks to get a visa for America in 1940-1941, even if they could have escaped from Nazi-occupied Netherlands. So in the light of the heart-rending photo of the Syrian girl, Kristof's immediate association with current events is very understandable, even though his comparison is more emotional than historical. The atmosphere of the Anne Frank House will certainly have contributed to this. The house invites its visitors to make a connection with history on a more emotional level and to reflect on the question of what that history means for us today. Kristof's appropriation of the history of Anne Frank in support of his plea for a more compassionate refugee policy almost immediately invoked heated responses, both from supporters and from antagonists. You can see one of these responses here. It's an opinion piece from the Jerusalem Post by a man called Alfred Fass, son of a Dutch Holocaust survivor. My Mother is Not a Syrian Girl is the cri de cœur of someone who objects to a comparison of the fate of Anne Frank and the millions of others who were murdered in the Holocaust with the fate of the victims of the Syrian civil war. The history of his mother is in many ways comparable to that of Anne Frank, born into a Jewish family in Germany, fleeing to the Netherlands after the Nazis came to power, forced into hiding during the war, and yes, there is one crucial difference, his mother survived. But despite this difference, it's very understandable why the writer of this reaction feels offended by Christoph's comparison. It doesn't concern, obviously, the question of whether the Syrian girl should be saved. Both writers are agreed on that. But the comparison that Christoph makes with the life story of Anne Frank, in Fess' words, and I quote Alfred Fess, "Why do I feel offended by Christoph's claim that Anne Frank is a Syrian girl? Because the Syrian girl is a victim of the hatred within the Arab people fighting among themselves in total disregard for the well-being and sustainment of life of their women and children. Anne Frank and my mother were victims of anti-Semitism. So please, Mr. Christoph, stop exploiting Anne Frank and my mother," unquote. Now, the fact that Nicholas Christoph uses the word shame and Alfred Fuss words like offended and exploiting indicates that there is much more at stake here than the simple question of whether a valid historical comparison can be made between the lives of Anne Frank on the one hand and Ruwaida Hanoun, the Syrian girl, on the other. There is a moral dimension underlying both Christoph's comparison and the negative reactions generated by his article. For Christoph, this moral dimension concerns the failure of the Obama administration and, in fact, the whole world to save children's lives by offering them a safe haven. And with his reference to the history of Anne Frank, he actually sharpens this moral dimension. Not only are we failing to protect Ruwaida Hanoun and with her thousands of Syrian children, but we are failing even though we have told ourselves for decades that we have learned the lessons from history, that we will make sure that Auschwitz will never happen again. We fail despite all the fine words and pledges during the commemorations of the Holocaust. We fail in the face of our own platitudes. When push comes to shove, we lack the will and the power to transform our words into deeds. The USA and the world failed to save Anne Frank, and now we are again failing to save Ruwaida Hanoun. That is the moral dilemma for Christoph. We may have all kinds of fine thoughts and words, but we fail to live up with them. Now for Alfred Fuss, the writer of this article, he raises a very different moral dilemma. The first thing that strikes you actually in his reaction is the kind of ownership that he claims via his mother of the remembrance of the Holocaust. My mother stands for my history. He feels personally addressed and even offended by Christoph's reference to this history. Because who has given Christoph the right to appropriate this history via Anne Frank and to put it on a par with a civil war in an Arab country? Or even, in more concrete terms, to equate his mother with a Syrian girl? He doesn't say it in so many words, but it's not hard to imagine what Fuss really means. Who or what gives the non-Jewish Nicholas Christoph the right and the freedom to refer to the Holocaust in relation to a civil war in an Arab country. Stop exploiting my history. His words are perfectly clear. My history, my mother, in a certain way, my Anne Frank, the immense tragedy that was inflicted upon the Jewish people cannot simply be exploited by anyone and everyone as a moral battering ram for anything and everything. The cry of Auschwitz never again may have acquired a universal meaning, but for Voss and many others with him, what is primarily at issue here is his remembrance of Auschwitz, the concentration and extermination camp, as the symbol of the attempt to eradicate the Jewish people. Now, this also concerns the moral question of whether the world in Syria is allowing another Holocaust to happen, or whether we should consider this as a large-scale local conflict which has indeed claimed many, many victims, but is not essentially different to many other conflicts and wars around the world. The question lies behind these two photos. In his moral dilemma, Alfred Voss, unsurprisingly, arrives at a very different conclusion as Nicholas Kristof. Voss regards the Syrian conflict as an Arab civil war, and therefore finds that the rich Arab countries should be the first to feel morally obligated to save and protect Rawaynda Hanoun and the other Syrian children. So when the Holocaust is no longer used as a point of reference, the circle of solidarity no longer encompasses the Obama administration or the world. It's restricted to a community of directly involved, and in the case, at least in Alfred Voss's eyes, the Arab countries. Now, moral dilemmas surrounding the appropriation of Anne Frank have arisen from the very start, that is to say, since the publication of Anne's diary in 1947. And undoubtedly, one of the most interesting and one of the most complicated of these dilemmas is the appropriation by her own father, Otto Frank. When Otto Frank returned to Amsterdam in June 1945 as the only survivor of those who were in hiding, and as a matter of fact as the only surviving survivor of his family, and it became clear that Anne had not survived the war, he was giving his daughter's diary papers, at least what had remained of them. The rest of his long life, he died in 1980 at the age of 91, it was dedicated to Anne's diary and to the Anne Frank house, the place where his family went into hiding and where Anne had written her diary. You might say that if anyone is entitled to an appropriation of Anne Frank, it would surely be her own father, with whom she had such a very strong bond. But nevertheless, moral dilemmas have arisen concerning that appropriation. The first one concerns the role of Otto in the publication of his daughter's diary. Anne's diary papers consist broadly speaking, of two different diaries. One, the diary that she kept as a child, and two, the adaptation of the diary as a manuscript that she started to write in 1944 and that she wanted to be published after the war. Of the diary that she kept as a child, a total of three notebooks survive, including the iconic first diary with its checked cover. It was given to her for her 13th birthday on the 12th of June, 1942, and at least one notebook has been lost. The last entry in this diary dates from August 1, 1944, 3 days before the people in hiding were caught and arrested.
You're listening to Ronald Leopold, Executive Director of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The manuscript that she started to write in March 1944 consists of 215 of these loose sheets. She was not able to finish it. They were caught before she could finish this manuscript. Now, Otto Frank, her father, knew about his daughter's ambition to have her diary published after the war, and he saw it obviously as his task to make that a reality. Partly at the urging of a small number of acquaintances who he had allowed to read the diary papers. Now, he had to base the publication on two incomplete or unfinished diaries. And that situation gave him, as editor, a key role that is clearly reflected in the final result. Otto's editing went further than just amalgamating the two versions of the daughter's diary. Parts of the text were left out on his initiative and his instructions, and among other things, some passages of a sexual nature and passages concerning Anne's very difficult relationship with her mother, about her parents' marriage, were left out in Otto's version. And this censoring role of her father was subject to much criticism 6 years after his death in 1986, when in a critical edition that was published in 1986, the papers were placed side by side with Otto's version in a critical edition. And because of the many omissions, he was said to have too much of his own stamp on his daughter's work, and so much so, actually, that he was recently described as the co-author of the diary of Anne Frank, a most unfortunate formulation in the light of the many attacks on the diary's authenticity, and one actually that mainly seemed to be motivated by a desire to safeguard the copyright on the diary and with it its revenues for a much longer period of time. He was certainly not a co-author, but he was an editor who did not hesitate to apply his own insights in the selection of texts that were ultimately included. In this way, Otto Frank has, in a certain sense, come to stand between the writer and the reader. That criticism of his editing, when you compare his version to the original writings of Anne, is very understandable. But the writer was his daughter, who, because of a tragic fate, was reliant on others to have her work published posthumously. And who other than her own father would be more entitled to do so? No less painful was the criticism of Otto Frank in connection with the stage version of the diary by the husband and wife writing team of Albert Hackett and Frances Goodrich. The play had its Broadway premiere in 1955. It has been staged thousands and thousands of times ever since. You might have seen it, maybe. It's still being performed here in the United States, week in, week out, in schools and community centers. But Otto Frank had commissioned, initially granted a commission for a stage version to an American author called Meyer Levin, you might probably know him, who had given an enormous boost to the popularity of the diary by writing a glowing review in the New York Times Book Review. But in the opinion of Frank and his producer, Meyer Levin, who as a journalist had actually witnessed the liberation of some of the concentration camps, among them Dachau and Bergen-Belsen, who had produced a work that, according to Frank, was not sufficiently appealing to the taste of a general American public. Now, that was soon construed as meaning a work that was too Jewish. Not, according to Frank, express the core values of American society. So Frank withdrew the commission from Levin and subsequently gave it to Hackett and Goodrich, who did not focus so much on the suffering of the Jews, but on the positive aspects of the diary, with the iconic quotation, and I quote the diary, "In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart," as its closing words. It was the start of an extremely painful and long drawn-out legal battle between Levin and Frank, which became actually the source of repeated accusations against Otto Frank of the de-Judification of his daughter in the interests of the commercial success of the play. And actually, those accusations were partly stoked also by the foreword that former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt had written for the English language version of the diary that was published in 1952, in which no reference at all was made to the Holocaust. The alteration of the original Dutch title, Het Achterhuis, and the house in the back, the house in the rear, usually translated as the secret annex, which was a direct reference to going into hiding, and which, moreover, was suggested by Anne Frank herself as the title of her book, to the English title, The Diary of a Young Girl, led many to suspect that this represented another de-Judification by her father of Anne Frank and her diary, just to pander to the taste of the American public. The new English title put much more emphasis on the coming-of-age aspects of the diary than on the Holocaust, and so captured the imagination of a young American audience much more than its original title. Now, Otto Frank actually never understood the accusation of the de-Judification of his daughter, because he had always connected the diary of Anne Frank with his own views, which had a much more universal character. For Otto, the diary of his daughter was what he called a document humain. It was a book with its central focus on the human, regardless of religious belief, regardless of ethnicity, regardless of worldview. In his view, the suffering that was inflicted on the Jews during the Holocaust was an example of the hatred, of where hatred between ethnic groups, between religions, between people can lead. The lesson of Auschwitz, the lesson of his daughter's diary, was not limited to the history of the Holocaust, but extend to encompass humanity as a whole. That's why the choice of Eleanor Roosevelt to write the foreword of the American edition of the diary was therefore no coincidence. Precisely she, and you know here in San Francisco, she was very much involved in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights here in this city. She was for Otto Frank the preeminent person to represent this mission. It was his specific intention to place the diary in this much more universal context. Attempts to protect Anne Frank against this appropriation by her own father have cropped up repeatedly. One of the most vehement attacks came from the hand of Cynthia Ozick, who in 1997, in an article in The New Yorker entitled "Who Owns Anne Frank?", totally dismissed the universal message of hope and human goodness that could be found in all manner of appropriations of Anne Frank. And I quote Cynthia Ozick, "The diary has been bowdlerized, distorted, transmuted, reduced. It has been infantilized, Americanized, sentimentalized, falsified, kitschified, and in fact blatantly denied. Among the falsifiers have been dramatists, directors, Anne's own father Otto, and the public, both readers and theatergoers all over the world. Otto Frank is complicit in a shallowly upbeat view of history, unquote. Jeffrey Chandler, professor of Jewish studies at Rutgers University, New Jersey, co-editor of an important book on Anne Frank, Anne Frank Unbound, I could recommend it to you, perceives, on the other hand, a synthesis between the Jewish background of Anne and Otto Frank, coming from Frankfurt am Main in Germany, and the more universal message mission that Otto Frank attached to this remembrance. In doing so, Jeffrey Chandler points out Otto's Jewish-German background, which was closely linked with the German concept of Bildung, education. It's not really, I don't know how to translate it into English. Bildung is a very, it's actually fulfilling the promise of the Enlightenment by making Jews like other people and an integral part of the society in which they lived. And it leads Jeffrey Chandler to the notion, which was foundational to both Anne and Otto Frank, that Jewishness is not inimical to universalism, but rather is realized in its embrace. And I would like to remark here also that it's important to know the restrained and occasionally downright negative reactions that some survivors have given to the popularity of the Diary of Anne Frank, and to the Anne Frank House, actually. This popularity has indeed generated a great deal of attention for the general history of the Holocaust, but it has also put the individual histories of the victims in the shade. They find it inimical that so much attention is devoted to the Diary of Anne Frank, whereas the horrors of the camps that so mark their individual histories are not addressed in the diary. A personality cult was the phrase of a girlfriend of Anne's sister Margot when she was interviewed by us and asked what it meant for her, the Anne Frank House and the Diary of Anne. A personality cult, she called it. And some of these survivors point an accusatory finger at Otto Frank. They say he had excessively marketed and exploited his daughter's life story. It might give you a different color, actually, to a famous quotation from Primo Levi, one of the other great authors about the Holocaust, who once said, "One single Anne Frank moves us more than the countless others who suffered just as she did, but whose faces have remained in the shadows. But perhaps it is better that way. If we were able to take in all the sufferings of all those people, we would not be able to live." The quote from Primo Levi. Now, the step from the dispute over the Jewish character or the universal character of Anne's diary to the place and the significance of the State of Israel in the remembrance of Anne Frank is obviously not a very big one. You have naturally recognized Shimon Peres, 2013, immediately prior to the start of the official visit that he paid to the Netherlands as president of the State of Israel. And in his speech in the House, he made a kind of implicit connection between the Holocaust and the existential threat to the State of Israel, partly in light of the Iranian nuclear program, which was front-page world news at the time of his visit. And I quote Shimon Peres when he said, "Anne's story is not just a memory. It is a warning as well, a warning to each of us and a warning to all of us," unquote. Now, we have decided to put that quotation into a video program inside the Anne Frank House. And it led to negative reactions from a number of Muslim visitors to the house. They let it be known that they were deeply affected by the Diary of Anne Frank, deeply affected by the Anne Frank House, but they found a connection with the politics of Israel unacceptable. Now, in the context of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, a appropriations are not restricted to Israel. This photo does make a direct reference to the fate of the Palestinians. Anne Frank, adorned with the well-known Palestinian shawl, the keffiyeh, and it was for a long time the logo on the BDS movement's Twitter account in Holland. BDS, I guess you know all about BDS, the calling for economic measures against Israel. The message of this appropriation is obviously provocative, but not immediately clear. Does this imply a comparison of the Holocaust with the situation of the Palestinians? Or is it merely a variant on what Otto Frank envisaged, and Frank as a kind of human rights activist standing up for those who were suppressed? It's a problematic and provocative appropriation, which makes a Jewish victim of the Holocaust a gambit in the struggle against a country that, in the words of Otto Frank, was the historical realization of the longing of the Jewish people for their own state. Now, a wholly new and very different perspective on the appropriations of Anne Frank and the moral dilemmas that accompany them opens up when we turn to two former perpetrators' countries, Germany and Japan. What role does the remembrance of Anne Frank play in the painful process of a country that has to come to terms with its responsibility of major war crimes? In Germany, just as in other countries, the memory of Anne Frank is largely determined by the culture of remembrance. And in respect to the Second World War and the Holocaust, this German culture of remembrance always revolves around the same question. How on earth could it ever have come to this? How was it possible that these crimes were committed in one of the most civilized countries in the very heart of Europe? How were we Germans capable of such atrocities? In this context, Anne Frank is a key point of reference for German self-examination and for dealing with the Nazi past. Through exhaustive and critical historical research, answers are sought for these questions with the hope of gaining some insight into the mechanisms that underpinned the moral breakdown that ultimately culminated in the Nazis' horrific killing machine. Over 70 years after the end of the war, this approach still applies. Also to a third and fourth generation, who obviously feel no longer a guilt, but still feel a great deal of responsibility for the crimes that were committed by Germany between 1933 and 1945. And it's clear that any message of hope and optimism, which form a part, an important part of the remembrance of Anne Frank in many other countries, has barely gained a foothold in Germany. Anne Frank symbolizes what the Germans had brought about. She's the ultimate victim who forces Germany into a painful process of fundamental self-analysis. Now, just as in Germany, the memory of Anne Frank also forms a part, and an important part, actually, of the culture of remembrance in Japan. But how different is the Japanese culture of remembrance? The question that Germany continues to ask itself have never played any major role, or at least not a major visible role, in Japan. A moral confrontation with Japan's own role in the Second World War has only come at a very late stage and to a very limited extent. In the culture of remembrance of Japan, the perpetrator role very soon became blended with a victimhood that is connected with the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It has actually led to Hiroshima becoming just as iconic a concept as Auschwitz, and to peace becoming the key word of a culture of remembrance that is chiefly centered on victimhood.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Ronald Leopold, Executive Director of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
It no longer matters whether these victims are victims of the Holocaust or are victims of Hiroshima or victims of Nagasaki. It's Anne Frank who symbolizes this victimhood. She's venerated a victim who stands as a symbol for all victims of all the wars. She seems to be adopted like a little saint in the peace cult of Japan. But peace, 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 wrote a Japanese visitor in our visitor's book in Amsterdam at the Anne Frank House. She is the ultimate symbol. She represents the innocence that is spread like a warm blanket over the perpetrator's role of Japan. Perpetrator, victim, bystander, helper, they all disappear in a hodgepodge that has led to, on the one hand, an enormous popularity of Anne Frank in the country, but also allows reference for former criminals of war in Japan. I do not wish to overlook the commemoration of Anne Frank in my own country, in the Netherlands. That culture of remembrance in my country, of which this commemoration also forms a part, has been subject to major changes in recent decades. After the first 15 or 20 years following the war, when the emphasis lay on the loss of national sovereignty and the actual and moral significance of the resistance against the occupying German forces, in the course of the 60s and 70s, the focus shifted to the victims and especially to the Jewish victims. And this occurred in light of the highly painful fact that in percentage terms, far and away, the most Jews were deported from the Netherlands of all Western countries, Western European countries. Of the total of 140,000 Jews in the Netherlands, more than 102,000, almost 75%, would be deported and killed. A percentage that contrasts starkly with countries such as Belgium and France, where the figure was around 30%. Now, various reasons can be suggested for this huge difference, but the fact that betrayal partly lay behind the fate of many Jews in hiding cannot be ignored. So, against this background, the remembrance of Anne Frank, which since the opening of the Anne Frank House in 1960 had acquired a dominant role in the remembrance of the Holocaust in our country, has led to sometimes fierce debate. Because is the memory of those many victims the central aspect of our remembrance? Does it concern the memory of betrayal that cost so many Jews in the Netherlands their lives? Is it the helpers of the people in hiding in the secret annex, people who had risked their own lives in order to help to save that of others, we must place in the foreground as a component of moral upbringing of new generations? Is the remembrance of Anne Frank consistent with the classic image of the Netherlands, which has held tolerance as one of its central tenets since the 17th century, has offered a wide range of groups a safe place of refuge against persecution in their own countries? Or is her life story, in fact, an example of just such persecution with a none too flattering role for the Dutch population? All questions worthy of interest, they're very difficult to answer. But remarkably enough, it was Otto Frank himself who always expressed very positive opinions about the role of the Netherlands and the Dutch people during the war. And as an indication of his attitude to the Netherlands, as a German who had lost his citizenship, He applied for Dutch nationality after the war, and he was granted it in 1949. And despite emigrating to Switzerland, he remained a Dutch citizen until his death. And he bequeathed his most precious possession, the diary papers of his own daughter, to the Dutch state. I gradually approach the end of my lecture, and this brings me to the organization that I've been privileged to lead over the last 6 years, the Anne Frank House. Since I took up my post as executive director, I've seen the most diverse and often rather curious examples of appropriations come my way. For instance, that of a German man who asked for my permission to print a quotation from Anne Frank's diary on the sail of his yacht, with which he wanted to make it clear to his fellow countrymen what they had brought about. Or the victims of Hurricane Sandy, who clung in their desperation to the diary's message of hope. Or the young people who were campaigning to save the whales and had read in the diary of Anne Frank how wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. Or a youth group in Poland who had set up a project aimed at combating violence against women, with Anne Frank as the ultimate example of violence against women. Once the victim becomes an icon, and then not just an icon, but in the case of Anne Frank, a queen among icons, moral dilemmas arise. Must she be protected against those who would use her as a tool for their own present-day political ends? Must she be protected against those who would wish to de-Judify her? Must she be protected against those to whom something has happened, as opposed to those to whom something was done? Must she be protected against those who would prefer to ignore their own roles as perpetrators? Must she be protected against those who shared her fate, the survivors, who suffered just as she did, and who look upon the personality cult surrounding her with abhorrence and pain? Do we have to demystify her and make her an ordinary girl again, which is anything but she wanted to be? Must she even be protected against her own father? And if we answer just some of these questions in the affirmative, then who should do the protecting? For a long time, the Anne Frank House has felt and expressed the responsibility to counteract the misuse and abuse of the memory of Anne Frank. And there were very good reasons for this. After all, what is at stake is a very vulnerable legacy that is threatened from all sides. Firstly, of course, from neo-Nazi circles, who have regularly denied the authenticity of the diary of Anne Frank, often as part of the denial of the Holocaust in general. Secondly, her memory is threatened by the pressure to commercially exploit it. Examples of Anne Frank merchandising constantly crop up. Roses and tulips bearing her name, to T-shirts, caps, underwear, Anne Frank snacks on the Amsterdam canal boats. The marketing does not necessarily lead to a devaluation of her legacy, but it does pave the way, in my view, for increasing superficiality. And thirdly, the remembrance of Anne Frank might be threatened by appropriations that simply have to be called into question, and I have referred to a number of them in my lecture today. Now, all of these threats, and each in its own way, form actually good reasons for the Anne Frank House to take action. After all, given the history and the mission of our organization, the involvement of our own father in the organization, and given our enormous reach, we play a central role worldwide in this remembrance, a role that brings with it a great responsibility. And the overarching question is whether this responsibility, which is reflected actually in every aspect of our work, should also extend to combating all those appropriations that we regard as undesirable. I have come to the conclusion, for all kinds of reasons, that we should not nurture that ambition. And the main reason for that is perhaps the fact that more than 70 years after the end of the Second World War, maybe the greatest threat to the remembrance of the life story of Anne Frank, the history of her time, is that no appropriation at all will be made of them. In other words, that this history is in danger of becoming ever less relevant to current and future generations. And it is precisely the fact that Anne Frank remains a source of inspiration in whatever contemporary context that her life story does not lose relevance, even if we might raise our eyebrows at the ways in which the connection with today's world is made. The second reason why we should be reticent about protecting Anne Frank against undesirable appropriations has maybe something to do with that. I think they form an outstanding opportunity to not only call attention to a life story, but also to enter into a dialogue on the pros and cons of comparisons between the past and the present, and the moral dilemmas that arise from this. And we really would miss out on this opportunity if we would limit ourselves to condemn and to protect. A third reason is that I think we need to be open to appropriations that might not initially correspond with our view, but that can nevertheless enrich us. For example, we, the Anne Frank House, not proponents of using the life story of Anne Frank for anti-bullying programs. I think because there is a big difference between persecution and bullying. But we do understand that the reasons why Anne Frank's diary is being used in all kinds of anti-bullying programs, especially here in the United States. It's a comparatively new addition to the educational work, and you may have very, very different ideas about it, but in any event, I think it adds a new color to the educational mission that can be connected to the diary of Anne Frank. The fourth reason is mainly prompted by a very practical consideration. In our digital age, any attempt to actively protect the legacy of Anne Frank against undesirable appropriations, and they have almost always have digital expressions, is doomed to fail. It's impossible to monitor all of these expressions, let alone to counteract them. And finally, we are aware that our mission is also a form of appropriation. The mission has a direct connection with what Otto Frank envisaged for the Anne Frank House. Yes, that's true. But it's not by definition the only possible, let alone the only acceptable appropriation of the life story of Anne Frank. I think reticence is appropriate when it comes to the ways in which others approach this remembrance. And I think one of the key factors in that is also that, in my view, it's very inappropriate and even highly morally problematic if we would speak on behalf of either Anne or Otto Frank, those who are not among us anymore, and pass judgments on their behalf. So to summarize the main points of our position, let me first say that I think that a historically reliable and authentic presentation of history, in this case the history of Anne Frank and the time she lived, is conditional if you want to be receptive to the very diverse appropriation of that history. In Otto Frank's words, to build a future, you have to know the past. We want to offer everyone the opportunity to, in his or own way, make a connection with the history of Anne Frank and give it a contemporary meaning, but without distorting history. We recognize the importance of bringing appropriations other than our own to the attention of our audience. 1.3 million visitors to the house, 6 million unique visitors to our own website. We are engaging between 600,000 and 800,000 young people every year in about 300 or 400 educational projects. And I think it's very important for our audience to learn about the other appropriations and not just to learn about what we as Anne Frank House have as our understanding of Anne's legacy. And I think some of the dilemmas that I have discussed in this lecture are ideally suited to inviting such reflection, even and maybe sometimes precisely because some of them leave us feeling very uneasy. I think another cornerstone of our position is the fact that we have chosen to be an educational organization. We have an educational mission. In particular, we want to make young people aware of mechanisms that lead to anti-Semitism, to racism, to discrimination. The life story of Anne Frank was the result of human actions, and it is, in that sense, a moral mirror for our own thoughts and actions. Her history forces us to reflect on who we are and how we can contribute to a community where people from very different backgrounds and beliefs can be themselves. Our mission focuses on attitude and behavior, on depolarization instead of political influence or social activism. To many who are closely involved, to many for whom the Holocaust is part of their own family history, the memory of Anne Frank has too many emotional aspects to apply it in the often turbulent political arena. Anne Frank, the victim, Anne Frank, the icon. Just two of the many faces that form her memory. I think we would do well to be open to all of these faces, which not only enables us to learn more about her, but also learn more about ourselves. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Ronald Leopold, Executive Director of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.